Welcome everyone to our discussion today, Unlocking Potential, Fostering Autonomy and Agency for Educators and Students. This is sponsored by our partner at the International Curriculum Association, ICA. ICA is an active, well-connected and global community of passionate educators who operate at the forefront of global education. It exists to champion quality, improve learning and unlock potential, and has been supporting the development of educators and learners for over 30 years. Our discussion today looks to explore the crucial topic of autonomy and agency for schools, their staff and students. A focus on agency enables individuals to take ownership of their learning journey and professional roles. By fostering autonomy and agency, we not only cultivate a sense of responsibility and self-direction among students, but also empower teachers to innovate and tailor their instructional approaches to meet diverse student needs. However, this approach doesn't come without its challenges. Through this discussion, we hope to explore workable strategies and best practices that really develop a culture of agency and autonomy. Welcome everyone for joining us today. Can we start with a quick round of introductions? So Richard, could I ask you to start?
Of course, yes. My name is Richard Pratt. I'm principal of a school called JPED, J-P-E-D. That's a small progressive international school in central Beijing.
Thank you. And Thomas?
Hello, my name is Thomas Holmes. I'm the head of primary at the British School Warsaw, which is part of the North Anglia Education Network. We're an accredited IPC school since 2021, and we're going through reaccreditation this year with the ICA.
Thank you. And Anne?
Hi there, I'm Anne Lautrette, and I'm the Deputy Head of Secondary at Taipei European School. And our school is currently MYP, IGCSE, and a diploma programme, but we're busy phasing out IGCSE to become an IB World School.
Thanks. And Patrick?
Hi, I'm Patrick Renneth. I've been teaching since 99. I've taught in a variety of schools from the UK and internationally. Most recently, I became a maths coach and have contributed to the concept-based inquiry mathematics program run by Rachel French. And I am transitioning into the world of being an independent maths coach as well.
Great. Thank you, everybody. It will be a really interesting conversation today. We had a quick discussion before we started about how autonomy and agency is such an important topic to teachers, knowing what their sense of autonomy in the classroom is like, and also for students. I'm so pleased to kind of have this conversation with you all. We're going to jump straight in, and Patrick, you're going to lead on our first question. So what strategies do you use to empower students to take ownership of their learning and make meaningful decisions about their education?
I think the strategies I've used in the past that have been really good really come from having a school identity of what it means, what are the values that they have around learning, and how does the school provide opportunities so that you in your classroom can really maximize that. So it's not just you in your classroom sort of trying to bring autonomy to learning, but it's a whole school effort. And I think that's very important, that there's a really clear vision for how teachers can help students do that. And I think, you know, with the PYP and things, you're very lucky to have things like the learner profile and the ATLs help to really start that off. And what I feel that's a strategy that helps there is shifting the perspective of learning from a product, an outcome, to a process. So when you focus on process and you focus on sort of holistic learning and skills, that allows the children to sort of free up a little bit and go into that autonomy. But alongside that, it's kind of the learning engagements that you plan need to be allowed to sort of like give children this chance to sort of exercise their autonomy. There's no point having a cookie cutter approach where everybody produces the same bit of artwork or whatever, because then they already give up, right? The children give up. So there's a few things in there that sort of come together to sort of create this sort of beautiful time where children can have autonomy. And I think teachers also must understand there's different types of autonomy. We're not just talking about free range chickens, like, you know, the kids are like, off you go and explore. It's not that. It's it's really well considered and well thought out sort of planning, like, here's a time where we allow lots of autonomy, here's a time where I may bring in their focus, and sort of having those sort of I learning engagements that promote inquiry, that promote questioning, and that you as a teacher have your hand on the rudder and you're steering the ship, but the children can help chart the course a little bit. So you're kind of almost giving them a compass and saying, we're heading in that direction. How would you like to go? And you as a teacher, you know the learning terrain so well. Sorry, I've switched from being maritime to being on land now, but you kind of know the direction so well, you know where you're going with your unit plan, that you can allow that sort of like that time for the children to explore and move through. So maybe I haven't really talked about strategies, but more it's about sort of the culture you set up in your class that allows children their ownership. I would say that's very important.
Yeah, absolutely. Are there any other thoughts on that?
Patrick, you talked about choice, and I'm just thinking with my sort of IPC, ICA hat on, and we have that cycle of children researching and then recording their learning and then reflecting on that, which is obviously so important. But within that recording element, you talked about not having a cookie cutter approach, not making sure there's nothing worse than having, you know, 20 sort of very similar pieces of work that really just show how well they follow an instruction rather than how well they've understood something or that they've developed a skill. So we've worked hard on looking at choice within agreed parameters, because giving free choice can create anxiety in some children, or they could spend the whole time thinking about the best way of recording their learning. But if you can give them choice within agreed areas, you know, either using certain materials or looking for a certain sort of way of showcasing their learning, then they have freedom to choose, but they're not completely left open to it. But then I think they also need to perhaps sometimes fail in those choices and realize that the choices they make will have a direct impact on what they've learned and how they showcase their learning. So perhaps they won't make that choice in the future, and that's just as important part of that cycle, that reflection time.
And I'd say especially in primary, we look at the idea of that would, to me, that publishing sort of like the how we choose to share learning would come from that understanding of what text types best support what it is you're trying to communicate. And so there's, you're right, it's not just like we said, it's not just free range chickens. We're kind of at different points saying, hey, with this learning, these things might be good times, or might be good ways of sharing your learning. And I think, again, if we go back to PYP, that all comes together in the exhibition where it is kind of like, okay, now it's over to you. And I think that's important that we kind of choose, we allow times when there's a greater choice and, you know, you have a selection, you might like to do it this way or that way. I think that's really important.
Exactly, yeah.
I think it's interesting that you kind of highlighting both of you. I think what is the tension, especially if you have an inquiry model in school, between what I kind of see as a continuum from this sort of free-range chicken style inquiry that is not really inquiry ultimately, that you talked about, to the opposite end of the spectrum that is inquiry that's so scaffolded that it becomes, as you said, cookie cutter. And so I think in terms of particularly supporting teachers, it's really important that we're very clear in defining what we mean by inquiry, and also demonstrating through lesson observation and through kind of model lessons, being able to demonstrate what it actually looks like when students are engaged in successful inquiry.
Something we're bringing in to the CBI Maths project, which is coming from the Erickson and Lanning kind of CBI concept-based inquiry, is the idea of inductive learning versus deductive learning. And so often, I mean, I grew up, I think, in a deductive learning, you know, model. It was like, here's what we're learning today, and we tell the children something that's true, and then we give them lots of case studies where they go, oh yeah, that was true. Whereas inductive learning kind of gives them more autonomy, because you give them lots of case studies and they look across it and it's like, what's the same about this case study, this case study, this case study, what's different? And from that, we start to create patterns. And then from that, they start to go, so that means this. And we're starting to bring their learning up, and they really helps to construct it in a more meaningful way and transferable way. And then it allows them to ask more questions where they go, so does that mean And often there's a knock-on effect, and that's sort of already allowing them in that world of that transfer and that sort of autonomy. And I think it goes back to that sort of what types of inquiry are there? There's guided inquiry, where I'm going to take you through the first time because you've never done this before. There's a structured inquiry where I'm going to be controlling parts of it, but parts are free for you. And then there's open inquiry where you've done lots of inquiry now. You understand how it works. What sort of things do you need to plan your inquiry? And I think it's important that as teachers, we sort of understand, we sort of not control that, but maybe facilitate that through the year, where, you know, you start off going, okay, it's more controlled here, now it's a little bit for you, now I'm bringing it back in, now it's wider. And we can create the times when there's more and less autonomy, because we need to focus our students in on what's important, because otherwise they won't know, and then go, okay, you've got what's important, now go play, and now come back in as we look at this, and now go play, and now come back in. So I think it's about sort of that variation of different types of inquiry and autonomy throughout the year.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for providing some examples. Like Anne was saying there, it's so important that there's a clear method in place to kind of model some of those examples so that teachers can really learn how effective they can be. But without having clear modeling, without having clear examples of how to do this effectively, you know, it really does need that structure, doesn't it, to support educators in developing greater autonomy for students. Thank you. So we're going to jump to our next question. And Richard, you're going to lead on this question for us. So in what ways do you support teachers in developing their autonomy and agency within their professional roles? And how does this impact their teaching practices?
Certainly pick up from Patrick that I think the word strategies is a little tricky here. It implies there are tricks or techniques, maybe a little playbook you can use to make things happen. And I actually do think it is about culture. Now, there are many factors that feed into culture, and coming out of the previous conversation, which is entirely what is true for students is going to be true for teachers too. A lot of it is about curriculum. We were hearing there about recognizing that there are different levels of desirability in autonomy. There are times when it is a continuum between high level of, in terms of working with students, a high level of direction. Sometimes it is a case of sit down, pay attention, I'm going to tell you something you need to know, the kind of thing that we celebrate and try to promote as being a feature of our school, high levels of student-centered, student-devised, and student-led interdisciplinary project-based learning. But it's always on a continuum. You have to think of it as a hybrid approach. And I think that the choices that we've made to move towards a highly independent curriculum. We do that within the US high school model. Our students graduate with our own diploma, but that's accredited by a US high school accrediting agency. That has given us a great deal of freedom to, in fact, build in that kind of spectrum of levels of autonomy. So across a six strand core subject high school curriculum, which actually feeds down through into primary as well. But one element of that is, we call it studios, but it is entirely student devised inquiry, student devised adisciplinary projects that where students select and devise their own areas of endeavor. And then at another level of the spectrum, there is, you know, these are kids who may well go to college where it is necessary that they can demonstrate that they've achieved a certain level of calculus, for example, in order to enroll on an engineering course or something. So where that's true for students, and picking up from what Patrick said, I think it's also true for teachers. There isn't a single template of a teacher. I think our curriculum, the fact that, and we are small, and smallness is also another one, but I could comment about that at some length. Pretty much all our teachers are also curriculum designers, because it is, we will only have one or two teachers in each year group for each subject area, for example, because our scale is so small. And we design our own program. And so the teachers have a high level of autonomy in that they are curriculum designers within a framework that we've created for them. But it varies. I mean, the joy in that opportunity varies from teacher to teacher. There are some who feel it's excessively onerous for them to be designing the curriculum. They almost would appreciate being given, you know, here is the study guide, work with this one. And then there are others who relish that high level of autonomy. So I think in managing teachers, you need to have a sense of who responds better with more direction and more sense of hand-holding and more explicit support. Who do you know will flourish if trusted with space and autonomy? So autonomy, I don't think is an unambiguous quality. We've gone into this conversation with the assumption that autonomy and agency are unambiguously good. I think they're highly desirable, but there are people are at different stages in their own development as to how much autonomy and agency is appropriate for them. And that's why it's highly important as a school leader or manager, not to, if you were like, have strategies, but to know your people. And so that's why I prior to my current position, I was head of a rather larger K-12 school elsewhere. And I went from leading a small school to leading a large one. I'll come back to leading a small one. And I find it harder to conceptualize school leadership beyond a certain scale, because so much of it for me, it comes down to knowing the team and knowing the individuals and knowing what levels of autonomy and agency to extend to each at different times. And there are some teachers I work with very closely, perhaps because I'm mentoring them through their PGC or something. There are other teachers, after an initial set of awareness of what they're doing, I'm very happy to, they know and I know that they pretty much have a carte blanche to run things their own way, because I know it's going to be fine. But how do I know that? I know because it's a small school and there's very high quality feedback from students and from the community and my daily learning, you know, walks around the school and they sort of what they call management by walking around. You know, how you do that on a larger scale, I think, is much more challenging. I don't really have tricks or strategies to provide to somebody who leads a large school community. I lead a very small one. Because I lead a very small one, I feel I can know the individuals and can then tailor my levels of, I like to call it support. I think support is also micromanagement. You know, one person's support is another person's micromanagement. And you kind of need to know your people. I think beyond a certain scale, that just becomes too hard. So I'm trying to jump in.
Yeah, is it? It might be interesting then to kind of throw that to our other educators who do work maybe on a larger scale and think about how do you support kind of teacher autonomy? Are there strategies that you use?
We're a relatively large school. We're 4 and 5 form entry in each year. And I think one of the challenges is when you're recruiting in international schools, you're recruiting great teachers, but have come from perhaps lots of different settings. Mm-hmm. So getting them to share in a vision that the school has and an expectation for certain, you know, levels of autonomy or choice or whatever that might be. And at the start, for some of them, especially if they perhaps come from a very traditional model, they need encouragement to let go and to allow children to make some choices and children to fail at making choices and teachers to take risks and allow them to fail, because that's part of the learning process. And I think in a large school setting, it's important to identify lots of people in different roles who are great examples of those things. So not just your subject leaders, not just your assistant and deputy heads, but those examples of class teachers or specialist teachers that are showcasing that and then can model that or share that with their colleagues in a way that's not coming from the top down. It's not micromanaging, but that's sharing across from peers. We have peer coaching across the school. So if someone is new, they will work with someone else and they work on specific things that they've agreed, and I haven't agreed with them, but they've agreed and they'll work through. And some of those might be giving choice or agency or developing that autonomy, but recognizing that teachers all come from different places, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're better or worse teachers. They just might need sort of to develop experience in certain different settings.
I completely agree. And I think that one of the things that is incumbent upon the leadership of the school is to make sure that you have a clearly articulated identity so that the people who do join your school are coming into the right place. You know, that, you know, we are very explicitly a school where we're not a school where if you're looking to build your career, for example, through the IBO, or you have had a lot of success delivering results in GCSE exams. I mean, preparing students or getting through exams. If you come to us presenting yourself as someone who's got strings of high achieving exam scores, and that your success as a teacher can be demonstrated through the performance of your students in public exams, you're probably not going to fit with us. And it's incumbent on me and the team to make clear that someone who is there are many different concepts of teaching and concepts of education, and it is inappropriate to suggest that any one of them is more desirable than any other. We work in, I'm based in central China. China is notorious for its heavily exam-based and testing-based culture of education. And there are international schools too that are highly sought after and very popular and successful that have a heavily test-based approach. If you are successful in that regime, in that style of school, I should say, you're probably not going to enjoy the kind of way we work. And so it's kind of important that even though recruitment can be challenging at times, that I don't bring in people, however well qualified and whatever famous schools they've been in, if the systems they've come from are going to mean that they are a little bit lost when they join us.
I'm interested in, as you were talking about recruitment, I suppose a unique challenge we perhaps face in my school with transitioning to a different style of program is that when we recruit, it's sort of easier than transitioning the staff that we already have, because we're clear on where we want to go now and therefore recruit for that. But actually moving along people who have been in the school for a long time is actually a little bit more difficult. And so with that, I agree totally. It's firstly about being uncompromising about who you are as a school and your identity, and being very clear to everyone who works in the school, no matter their longevity, that this is our mission and vision, and this is where we're going, and this is how. But I think it's also really important to take a close look at all the policies and procedures and practices and ensure that they're all in alignment with that particular direction in which you want to go. So as an example, I know, we had a shift away from, we want more agency for teachers and students. And therefore that meant that we needed to make shifts in our appraisal process, away from an appraisal process and more towards a peer-to-peer support model. We wanted to talk about professional growth rather than professional development, because we want to support that. Mm. So it's analyzing every aspect of school life and community, really, to make sure that it's all very much in alignment with that vision. So especially when you make change, sometimes things can get a little bit out of alignment, and then that's confusing for people who work in school.
No, I completely agree. I'm aware of the experience of the transition you described from previous situations. Because one of the challenges you then have is you have teachers who have built a professional record through success in a particular system. And then when you change the system, I'm sure you're facing this, when you change that system, you're in some ways robbing them of the pathway that they've been endeavoring to build, endeavoring to create. They've had success in a particular style of work, and you're rendering that invalid. And yeah, that can be quite tricky to manage. And that comes back to, again, this sense of, we talk about autonomy and agency, but because I want to bring it back to the theme of the talk, extending autonomy does depend on the kind of trust. Right? You have to trust your teachers. And if you don't trust your teachers, why have you got them on your team? Except that's easy to say, because often you inherit a situation, or you take over a school that had, you know, actually our school, the school I currently head, has taken over another school, literally taken over another school. It is a merger. And you then take on board a set of practices and ideas that it then have an exercise to realign those expectations around. You know, you want to extend trust, but they are not as yet acculturated into the mission and vision to which you identify. And so then there's that, yeah, working on that spectrum, like, yes, I trust you. I know you, I trust you, but do I trust you to get it? And if you don't, the responsibility is on me to make sure you get it, to help you get it. It's a long-winded response. I'm sorry, I should cede the territory.
I think that this is kind of brought up that, you know, this is a far more complex topic than just suggesting ways in which teachers then can be autonomous and then here it is. And that's a kind of answer to the problem, because, you know, yeah, schools are all different. You know, like Patrick was saying, that there can't be cookie cutter kind of approaches to this. Mm. We really do need to kind of think about each individual setting here. But I want to then think about examples then of successful strategies. So Anne, I was going to ask you to lead on our next question. If you are able to share some successful initiatives or strategies that you have implemented to promote autonomy and agency amongst students.
Yeah, I think we can sort of separate into two aspects. The aspect that is kind of in the classroom, and we talked already about curriculum, pedagogy, and autonomy perhaps within assessment, as we talk through some of the inquiry approaches potentially. And then I think we could also look at things that lie outside of the classroom and how we can offer autonomy to students there too. So certainly within the classroom, as we've talked about, having student choice, perhaps involvement in curriculum design, ensuring that we're focusing on real world relevance within the curriculum, scaffolding inquiry, as we were talking about, shared collaboration with students around classroom rules, around how we operate within a classroom, choice in presenting how they show understanding through options within assessment, options within learning, and potentially students designing assessment criteria and working with teachers to design rubrics that would best assess the work that they're doing. And all of those would be strategies that I think teachers can use within the classroom. But then as a sort of more strategic approach on behalf of a school, I think we can certainly look at having student-led school services and projects. For example, in my school currently, we have a student-run cafe. We also have peer mentoring, peer tutoring. We have sustainability committee. We have student-led focus groups who operate slightly outside of the student council to look at, do some in-house research for us on student opinion about particular focus areas like assessment or well-being. Or this year we have a student focus group around authentic learning. And it's a student who leads that, who brings together the committee, who produces a report, who presents to the teaching body at the end of the year as to what they've found out. Student councils, I mentioned, are important, I think, in terms of ensuring that they're not, in some schools, student councils can essentially become kind of events organizing committees from which they learn a whole lot, but it doesn't necessarily engage them in strategic school decisions. And so I think it's important that student councils have some power to shape school policy. And then alongside with that, we engage our students in leadership development. So next week, I'm leading a Saturday with all of our student leaders on skills development for as leaders. An initiative that we just introduced in my school last year was to ensure that students have their voice within their reports. So reports traditionally place where it's between the teacher and the parent. And so we quite recently decided that actually the student voice was the most important. And so now they engage in reflective activities during a week prior, and then they write a reflection, which is it goes on the end of year report. And we're just about to revisit those reflections with students now at the beginning of the next year, to look at the sorts of things that they said that then lead into how they approach this new school year. So that's all very much about really putting students in charge of their learning journey. And so therefore, in terms of developing autonomy, I think, you know, if they feel that school is not being done to them, but that they are leading their ability to learn within the school environment in all the ways that we can possibly make that happen. Then when we talk about developing lifelong learners, which is, I think, what we all want to do, I think ensuring students have some sense of agency is probably at the root of that.
Might I add on to that, Anne? Because I love all that, because one of the things that I found very transformative when I moved to Singapore was when we did student-led conferences and then the three-way conferences, and just how the parents were always kind of so taken aback by the way, you know, even the younger children spoke about their learning. And I just always think that's so lovely, the idea of their voice on the reports. That's something I've not yet seen, like where they'd have their own little written bit. That's great. And I was thinking about what you said about learning isn't done to the children. And it just made me think about how we make schools that the children feel like it belongs to them. And that I think one of the key things is to let them know they're not the only ones learning in the school. And that I remember when I was at UWC, where they used to say, everyone who steps onto this campus becomes a learner. This is a place of learning. So it doesn't matter who you are, what your role is in the school. If you work in the canteen, if you are, you know, the head of school was always learning. Everybody is learning. And parents, when they were invited in, were also invited to learn. And I think that helps the children understand. It's like, oh, it's not just us. Like my mum and dad or whoever's, you know, my family comes here and they learn too. And we're all on this journey together. And when I was a classroom teacher, we had instructional coaches, and I would bring in the instructional coach to say to the children, okay, I'm learning as well. And then I became an instructional coach. And it's been making me think about this all the way through, about how that's actually one of the quickest ways to get autonomy to your teachers and to your students, is having instructional coaches where teachers are in charge of what they want to learn, and then the students see that, and then that kind of feeds into what they're doing as well. So I a bit meandered from your point, but yeah, I loved what you said about learning isn't done to children, and we need to find ways to make schools where everybody is learning. None of us are finished products, and we all have choices in what we learn next. So I think that's really cool.
Absolutely, I completely agree, especially in terms of, well, I think we were talking earlier about failure and how important it is for not just kids to fail, but teachers to fail too, and to for it to be okay that happens. And I think certainly from a leadership perspective, we want our teachers to take risks. And if it goes wrong, it goes wrong. We can learn a lot from that. And I think that's part of developing exactly that kind of culture that you're talking about, that develops then the culture of trust for teachers, which then filters to the students, so that everyone is able to demonstrate that they're on a journey to continue learning.
Have you seen, and I've said this before in other things as well, James Nottingham's The Learning Pit? It's just the most wonderful visual representation of learning. And it sort of takes away the idea that learning goes from here to here. It's actually, effective learning looks like falling backwards. If I think about the things I've ever truly learned, I've really struggled with them. And it's, I've kind of got worse at it before I've got better, but you come out on the other side higher up. And then if you've done it really well, you don't actually need to go into that pit again, but you will find yourself in another pit. And pits are different depths and different lengths according to different abilities. But I think as soon as students understand that learning is difficult for everybody, they're more inclined to, well, usually roll their sleeves up and get in. And sometimes I say to the children, it's like, we're really going to get in the pit today. And I've used this before because I think it's just so transformative that children understand that, oh, I'm meant to be grappling with this at an appropriate level. I'm meant to be. And then they can talk about that when they do their reports, right? They can say, this was something I really grappled with, and that was okay because I had to go through that in order to come out better at the other end. And I think as long as they can identify that, then it's fantastic and parents are usually happy. And I think anyone who says, oh, I found that easy, they're just showing you what they already know, right? So that's important.
Yeah, absolutely. And all of these things, it really does lead into a greater sense of well-being for students and for teachers to have that sense of being trusted, of having that sense of being listened to, and having the freedom to make mistakes and to try again and think about your approach to things. I think all of this is so tied up in the way that we kind of move forward and consider student and teacher well-being as well. So we're going to lead into our next question. Tom, you're going to lead for this one. How do you measure the effectiveness of autonomy and agency initiatives?
Well, I think to start with, it's perhaps tricky to measure in a traditional sense. You don't get a test score for autonomy or agency. There's no standardized age-related expectation for certain things, or it's very hard to measure. So it has to happen in a number of different ways. I think the first is to listen to your students, and that's done through, you know, regular surveys or focus groups, gathering their perspective. And I think it's always interesting to hear, especially, you know, in a primary school, a seven-year-old won't lie to you about their learning. They will tell you how they found things. They will tell you what they enjoy, what they don't enjoy, what they want help with, what they want to do on their own, you know, what they want to be left alone to do. So we have sort of opportunities to listen to those students, and it's always insightful and always leads to a next step. Mentioned before that we, you know, the importance of having student leadership groups, and it's those groups that often give you different perspectives. So whether it's, you know, we have a group that focuses on our love of reading, but looking at what they might say might be very different to the eco group that we have, or to the global group. So they'll give different perspectives. So it's important to listen to lots of different student groups. We recognize and record and celebrate not just the sort of academic progress, but also that personal, their personal learning goals and their development of people. So it's important to sort of recognize and measure that in a way. A simple way, we have individual records of achievement which children complete, and they're based on their personal learning goals. So they're based on whether they're adaptable or ethical or collaborators, communicators, and they can see the progress they make. So that's their record. We're not judging them. It's up to them to see how they've developed, and then therefore they can measure the success that they've had. I think visiting classes, I know, Richard, you spoke before about walking around, but that really does give you a feel of whether things are going well, whether people are aligned with the school's vision. And so being present in those classrooms, talking to students in their classrooms, especially when those perhaps wider choice areas or wider freedom moments are happening, that you recognise that it's not just sort of, it might look a little more chaotic or certainly more than a traditional old school lesson, but you talk to those students about their learning, and that really helps us see whether they're talking about learning and not doing. They're talking about the skills they're developing or the learning goal that they're focusing on, but they're not talking about the way they're recording it. They're not saying, I'm completing this. So I think that's important to have those conversations with younger students, and get them to reflect on their learning as well. And you can see a lot from children when they reflect on what they've learned and how they've learned. And if they say, you know, they've enjoyed making a choice to record their learning through a certain way, and then some children will say that they haven't enjoyed that or it didn't go very well. So talking to children is so vital. I'd be interested to hear in different settings how others in this group perhaps measure autonomy and agency.
I think often it's observation, because this may again be reflect your setting or your context, but we often students will tend to come to our school because they will come from schools that are more traditional. There'll be more large classes, there'll be more exam focused, more kind of direct or tightly controlled curriculum. And they'll come in, and they'll come in, and it'll be like, they'll either immediately recognize the greater liberty that we give, and they'll abuse it initially. So then there'll be a journey of helping them to see that, you know, with the kind of liberty that is a feature of our school and unusual against the background where we're based, comes with a greater expectations of self-discipline and responsibility than they, because if you were the externally imposed discipline through sanctions, if you like, is traded for we try to train a much more significant internal. That doesn't mean that, and that for some students that's a wrestle, particularly if they're joining us a little bit later. They're joining us as teenagers, usually because they've chafed under the regime at another school, and then so initially they can. But then the reverse is almost more common, is who come to us who simply don't express themselves. They're very inhibited and withdrawn, and the environment that we try to create, which does celebrate individual agency and does create spaces. Many of the things that were just said, I mean, Tom, you just mentioned clubs, you know, the student-led groups and activities that part of a, you know, your greater curriculum, where these some of the most meaningful things, the things that are most meaningful to students, are often those, not what happens in the formal curriculum. And so the observation, this comes back to kind of knowing your kids, knowing your team, the observation of them evolving as people, watching the ones who maybe exploited the license, as they saw it, of a more liberal regime to the one that they came from, then having to learn to learn the good citizenship that comes with that trust. Or alternatively, the ones who came who were so sort of repressed and inhibited by their previous experience, seeing them become more forthcoming and confident and, you know, flourish. And that observation is how do we know it's happening? I mean, you watch it. Watch it happening. That's why you know it's happening.
What do you do when you have a child who seems to be struggling with a more autonomous setting? What do you do if a child, you know, is craving really tight parameters or thinks they should be looking for them? How do you get the best out of those children?
I mean, to be honest, they're probably not likely to choose our school in the first place, but absolutely. And so within an advisory structure, so we have a pastoral structure, which is probably not too different from most, where there's some small homerooms, sort of advisory groups that are meshed within homerooms or grade level structures that are larger. So it's, everyone's in both small groups. It's a fairly conventional structure, I would imagine. But yes, the individual mentoring of kids who struggle because they have been so accustomed. Now, we are from grade 1 through to grade 12, so we have very small ones. And over time, the ones who've lived through the system, this becomes less of an issue. The kids who join us as teenagers, having known different things, there are some who flounder a bit in exactly the way you describe, and they need, we say autonomy and agency. I go back to the point I made earlier that it is a continuum, and there's going to be times when, just like some teachers need high levels of mentoring and support, there's going to be some kids who, so you have to know them.
Yeah, I'd add on to that with, yes, I mean, I, when it comes down to it, you can give someone an autonomy of choice between two things. You're still giving them autonomy. It's just, we're really down at this end. And, you know, and then you can build up and just, it's almost a bit like, you know, those awful stories you hear about bears that have been in a cage, and then you open the door of the cage and the bear does not go out. because they understand they're kind of institutionalized. They'll stay in their cage, right? And the idea of what's outside the cage is too much. So how do we coax the bear out and sort of, you know, what can we do to do that? So I think it's, yeah, just slowly understanding what autonomy is. And I think it's very difficult to be autonomous when you don't understand yourself. So I remember when I moved from the British system, and as a teacher, I was just kind of, I felt like I was told what to do. And I just did this. And this was the scheme we used. And then I moved into UWC. And all of a sudden, it's like, well, what do you feel as an educator? And I remember feeling almost paralyzed, like, why does that matter? Just tell me. And then beginning to understand myself and understand everything, that helped me to kind of go, you know, you almost have to learn to trust yourself. So how do we build, it's not just having trust in the within the school as a trusting environment and community, but how do we build that trust within children for them to listen to their instincts and go, yes, that's what it is. Because ultimately that's what serves us as adults in the real world. It's trusting our instincts, understanding how we learn from our previous experiences. And if you've never been given that choice, if you're just told, this is what success looks like, this is what you do, this is how you do it, then you go, okay, well, that's all I know. And so when we move to schools which are less like that, and there's kind of like introspection and reflection, that can be really, really challenging. So I wonder how we build that self-trust and that self-esteem essentially in children for them to be able to make those autonomous choices because they know it's best for them, not because they're going to please the adult who's in charge of the room they're in. I think that's important.
And yeah, so I guess that, oh, sorry.
No, you have it. You have it, Tom, please.
I was only saying, I guess that's where it leads to what I mentioned before, is the need to develop those personal learning goals so that children become sort of resilient and adaptable, that they're aware of their strengths, that they're aware of the areas that they're working on, that they're aware of their peers and how to celebrate each other. Because if you don't develop those things, if you only focus on, you know, what the curriculum objectives are or whatever that is, then you don't allow them to develop themselves when they're faced with more choice.
No, I really don't want to absolutely don't want to hog the screen at all. But the metaphor that always gets used here is scaffolding. But the important thing about this scaffolding is remembering that something inside the scaffolding has to be made secure, and then the scaffolding is taken away. The idea that the metaphor of scaffolding is so frequently misrepresented, in that the thing that is forgotten is the scaffolding is a temporary process. And that is the whole point of it, is to ensure that the thing inside can then stand up by itself and you can take the scaffolding away. So we can retain the metaphor, but we have to apply it a little more accurately.
Otherwise, it's one of those landmarks that never comes out of scaffolding. Yeah. Or whenever you visited it, you're like, oh, it's covering up again.
I mean, some really, really sage points kind of raised there. And I think that that will relate to a lot of people in terms of their experience of trying to develop greater autonomy and how they do that for students, those who are much almost those passive learners who kind of just allow the information to just be given to them and they want to just learn in that way, but it's not actually kind of an active learning role, trying to develop them into those active learners and really develop that sense of autonomy. It's really tricky, but some really interesting points that you've raised there to help develop that sense of agency. And you're going to lead our final question. So what advice would you give to schools looking to enhance autonomy and agency within their community?
Yeah, I think I think we've given a lot of advice already, I hope. But on top of the things that we've already said, I think tied up with the last discussion actually is really about promoting whole school ownership, I think. As I was talking about previously in terms of students owning their learning, similarly, we want teachers to own their teaching and not... I don't really want teachers to feel like Patrick did, as he was saying, just give me the curriculum and I'll just do that thing. So I think we want them to own their teaching. And then similarly, when we broaden it out to community in terms of parents, and we want parents to feel that they have a real stake in the school as well. And so I think some of that comes with allowing decision making to also be a community decisions where possible. And of course, not every decision can be made by an entire community, but I think On the flip side to that, nothing kind of kills agency faster than fake decision-making power that it doesn't really exist. And so determining in which decisions can we give agency to members of the community, and then making sure that you do that and that you actually do listen to that feedback, those decisions, and that you take them on board and that you act on them, rather than sort of pretend that people have input but then doing what you were planning all along. So I think that sensible school ownership is really important. We've talked already a lot about leadership opportunities for students. I also think developing leadership opportunities for staff, removing the kind of very traditional hierarchical structures that we have in schools sometimes, and ensuring that staff are able to have opportunities for leadership, whether they have any kind of formal leadership role or not. So I know in my own school, we established professional learning communities just last year, but we were very keen in those communities to ensure that it wasn't anybody that has a formal leadership responsibility that was chairing those groups, because often that becomes a sort of natural default person to default for decisions, and then therefore the group doesn't really get that decision-making power that I was talking about earlier. I think for teachers, in terms of empowering them essentially through, for example, professional development, similarly to how we were talking about students earlier and there being a continuum, I think the same for teachers when it comes to professional development. If you open up, well, you can do whatever you want, here's some money, go and spend it how you want on your own professional development, then you can likely have the lack of alignment, people going in all different directions in terms of away from the school mission and vision. But at the same time, if all you do is have a top-down professional development in a program where everyone goes through the same program, then we remove completely any sort of personalization or of sense of autonomy with that. So I think there's a balance to be found, and that depends very much on your school community and where your school is in its journey, I would say. And I think we've also talked many times now about reflection and the need for the community to be established as a reflective one. So again, I think that's about providing space, particularly for teachers within, whether that be staff meetings, department meetings, shifting them very much away from being information giving to being about professional growth, about development, about reflection, and about moving forward as a community. So I think very much, if I could give one piece of advice, I guess, to anybody who wants to increase agency and autonomy, it would be really to look at your own school community, really realistically assess where you are in terms of the levels of agency and autonomy that teachers have, and then ask yourself what is the next step that would provide more. Because as we said before, if you open the cage to the bear, the bear isn't going to go out if the bear's been trapped inside for so long. And so therefore it really is about scaffolding, ultimately, to be able to remove the scaffolding, of course, but scaffolding that autonomy and agency for everyone within the community.
I think you make a very good point, Anne, and I would just extend on to that, the importance of, in terms of you reference hierarchy or organization, the clarity over organizational structures, so people know where their devolved powers are. We want to devolve power, authority to individuals and give them autonomy. People need the security of knowing where those boundaries are for their decision making. And so while it sometimes seems a slightly unromantic or perhaps unpoetic thing to dwell on, I do think that the organizational chart and the job descriptions are really important, because they give people that sense of, you have been given this space. You report to this one person, you have been given this space, and you have authority over these decisions. And so if you like a written constitution that empowers people, and so that that gives, I think, a certain amount of security. I've worked in environments where lines of authority have been ambiguous and areas of autonomy have been, there's been a lot of rhetoric about wanting to empower people, but a lot of ambiguity over where the boundaries of that authority lie. So people reluctant to engage with it because they don't feel the security of it being a documented and transparent and public statement of who has what agency in what space.
I think that's, yeah, I was thinking about that when we were talking about measuring autonomy and the success of initiatives before. And I was thinking, you know, if, for example, you offer to, whether it be students with the opportunity to take on leadership roles or to be part of focus groups or whatever it is, and you have those opportunities for students, and similarly you have opportunities for staff to want to be chairs of PLCs or to lead focus groups or whatever that is, how many people want to do that? Because I think that's a measure of the culture that you have in terms of autonomy and agency. Because if people are reticent, perhaps it's because they feel like they won't really have any kind of autonomy or agency in those particular spaces. So what's the point?
You'll still get the blame.
So I think we can measure wrong, yeah. In part by that.
Great. Are there anything else that anybody wanted to say here that we haven't had an opportunity to say? I think we've covered quite a lot. Yeah, it's been a fantastic discussion. Thank you, everybody, for joining us today. You can learn more about all of our educators who are part of this discussion underneath this article. And I'm sure all will be happy if you wanted to send them a message or to learn a little bit more about them. You can find them here. Thank you, everybody, for your time today.